Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Fourth Age. I, of course, am Andrew Gellis, and with us this time is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be here, as always. And with us also for this episode, we have Spencer.
Hey, everyone. It is great to be here. Also with us this episode, joining us after you know, life gets in the way and a long hiatus, we have Carrie.
Hi, everybody. Hi. I'm glad to be back. We have a new addition tonight. His name is Daniel.
Hello, everyone. Nice to join you. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Well, we welcome you to the podcast. We're glad to have you here. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I am a longtime Wheel of Time fan. Born to Charleston, South Carolina parents from the real Two Rivers, and a fan of this series for ad nauseum. So I live in Boston, but I commute to New York for work, and I'm thrilled to be joining with you and being part of the podcast. And I actually had a great opportunity to join up with you as part of the live broadcast for some of the early release pieces as part of the Towers of Midnight release party. So I'm thrilled to have a chance to be a contributing listener, longtime listener to the podcast, and it's really a great pleasure to be part of the crowd.
So with that said...
All right, this is Brandon Sanderson giving you a warning that this podcast includes spoilers. Spoiler alert, don't listen unless you've read all the books. Otherwise, we will hunt you down and beat you up.
Threats of violence from our beloved creator in training.
No one said that birthing a world was an unviolent experience.
Yeah, really? Yeah. Well, Brandon ought to know he's birthed enough of them already.
I know.
So, going on with our impressions of Tower of Midnight, I believe the first thing that we had considered discussing was the visions that Egwene had toward the beginning of the book.
Do you want me to read it through?
Mm-hmm. That'd be great.
She stepped into her dream and into his embrace. They stood in a small stone-walled room shaped like her study in the tower, yet decorated like the common room of her father's inn. Gawain was dressed in sturdy Two Rivers woolens and did not wear his sword. A more simple life. It could not be hers, but she could dream. Everything shook. The room of past and present seemed to shatter, shredding into swirling smoke. Gawain stepped back, gasping, as Gawain ripped apart as if made of sand. All was dust around her, and 13 black towers rose in the distance beneath a tar-like sky. One fell, and then another, crashing to the ground. As they did, the ones that remained grew taller and taller. The ground shook as several more towers fell. Another tower shook and cracked, collapsing most of the way to the ground, but then it recovered and grew tallest of all. At the end of the quake, 6 towers remained, looming above her. Egwene had fallen to the ground, which had become soft earth covered in withered leaves. The vision changed. She was looking down at a nest. In it, a group of fledgling eagles screeched toward the sky for their mother. One of the eagles uncoiled, and it wasn't an eagle at all, but a serpent. It began to strike at the fledglings one at a time, swallowing them whole. The eaglet simply continued to stare into the sky, pretending that the serpent was their sibling as it devoured them. The vision changed. She saw an enormous sphere made of the finest crystal. It sparkled in the light of 23 enormous stars, shining down on it where it sat on a dark hilltop. There were cracks in it, and it was being held together by ropes. There was Rand, walking up the hillside, holding a woodman's axe. He reached the top and hefted the axe, then swung at the ropes one at a time, chopping them free. The last one parted, and the sphere began to break apart, the beautiful globe falling in pieces. Rand shook his head. Egwene gasped, came awake, and sat upright. She was in her room in the White Tower.
She actually did interpret a couple of those immediately thereafter.
Right.
She didn't touch on the first one at all, but she felt that she knew what the other two meant, and that usually is a pretty good sign.
Yeah, if she knows what it is, then she knows.
Yeah.
But she says
It's right here. It's, she breathes in and out. Rarely did dreams unsettle her as much as this one had. Calming herself, she reached down to beside her bed, picking up the leather-bound book she kept to record her dreams. The middle of the three this night was the clearest to her. She felt the meaning of it, interpreting it as she sometimes could. The serpent was one of the Forsaken, hidden in the White Tower, pretending to be Aes Sedai. Egwene had suspected this was the case. Varen had said she believed so. Oh, and then to get the last one, we actually have to skip into the meeting with Rand, and I'm going to take a second to find that one real quick.
She didn't say she knew what the first one was with the towers, right? She thought it had something to do with the Shanchan, didn't she say?
Or it doesn't actually say.
It doesn't say. It doesn't say anything. What am I thinking?
Yeah.
Wow.
And she also reflects that what she sees in the dream isn't necessarily what is going to happen, but what might happen.
Right.
So it isn't carved in stone, apparently, even though she does know what it means. Apparently it can be changed. I think she probably nailed it with the eaglets, you know, being
right.
That's, you know, the Forsaken. That's pretty obvious. I don't think we really need to spend a lot of time on that one unless somebody has some insight into that that has escaped me, which is
well, so
possible.
So the only question about that, Virginia, is who is she, the eaglet's mother? Who's the mother in this? So I could buy the argument that Mesaana is the eaglet posing among them and serving sort of as the serpent, or the serpent posing among them and serving as the serpent that will devour the eaglets. But who's the mother?
Well, the Omerlin Seed is the mother of the Aes Sedai, and they address her as mother. So
because
that would be kind of.
She said that the it was their sibling, or they thought of it as their sibling. So that would make Egwene the mother and all the other Aes Sedai sisters, right?
And why is she absent in the vision? So again, we have resolution to the Mesaana story within Towers of Midnight. So it's not as though we don't know what's going to happen, right? We have an outcome. But why is she missing from the interaction?
Yeah, is that's true. Why isn't she defending the eaglets? And
right.
Why is she not interacting?
Maybe because she's out getting food for them.
Is this a warning to her? So, you know, again, watching how it plays out within the story itself, is this a warning to her that she fails to heed about her plan in the dream world? That she needs to be more tied to what's going to happen? Because, you know, there's some play in terms of what happens later that she's not quite where she needs to be, and there's risk. But she almost loses her life in that interaction.
Right. Yeah, she does.
That's true.
And she pushed away the very person who needed and wanted to defend her against all comers, which was Gawain, and left herself basically almost defenseless, sleeping, while she's battling, you know, in the White Tower.
Right.
And
yeah.
Which is basically kind of what happened in the vision. She was, you know, doing other things, thinking she was defending, which she could have went the other way.
Well, but I have a question about that, too, because we kind of assume it was Mesaana because she thinks so, but Mesaana isn't responsible for the deaths that happened in the White Tower. Those are the Blood Knights.
That's
right.
True.
But the serpent was pretending to be one of them, pretending to be one of the siblings. So
the thing
that leans towards the Forsaken, how they're always
the thing with the middle dream that is significant to my mind is that they very much state that Egwene knew what it meant. And they've only ever referred to Egwene's knowledge of future events through her dreaming ability as in the phrase of when she knows, she knows. So the fact that, you know, they state that she knew that Mesaana was the serpent, that seems to, at least to me, impart that because she was a dreamer, that interpretation wasn't so much a matter of I need to figure out what it means, and so much that the meaning literally came to her with the dream.
Yeah, in that respect, she's a little bit like Min, because Min sees all kinds of visions and doesn't know what most of them mean, but when she does know what it means, it comes at the same time, and she just knows. So there is that similarity there. But Min seems to know what things mean a lot more often than Egwene does. Egwene has had to work a lot harder to interpret the dreams. And only once or twice have we actually heard her, or, you know, mentally reflect that she knows what that means. One was the one with the white lantern, or the white lamp, with the droplets of oil on the top of the White Tower being attacked by the ravens, you know, overset, and the droplets of oil spraying everywhere. She knew what that meant, and she was quite convinced of it anyway. I can't recall another one. I think the other one that she knew what it meant was the one where she saw Gawain taking two paths, and she didn't know, you know, in one she's accepting it, and the other one she's trying to turn him around from the path, and she knew one led to his death, and the other led to his dying of old age married to her, but she didn't know which one was which. I don't remember if she knew any others. No, I don't, can't recall that she did. So it's very possible that we got the vision on that one and the resolution all in the same book, which is, I guess we're just suspicious because that just never happens. You know? Usually we're strung along for, you know, a decade or so.
but the news is we are coming to resolution ultimately, so that would make sense. It can't be strung out too much longer.
Right. Yeah, there's only one more book.
Yeah.
Unless it's one of those things that Robert Jordan specifically wrote, this does not get resolved.
Right.
I'm dreading those, let me tell you.
I know. But it gives us something to ponder. So, anyway, depends on what it is.
So what about...
The other vision that she was sure that she knew what it was, although she didn't actually say that, was the one with the crystal being held together by ropes, and Rand chopped the ropes apart and let the crystal fall into pieces, and I have to agree that the obvious interpretation is what she thinks, that Rand's going to break the seals, and that's basically the Dark One's prism that we're seeing falling apart, and it kind of reminds me of the Sharoam, or whatever it was, I think it was the Sharoam, that Rand witnessed in the Age of Legends when he went through the Aiel Array in Meridian.
So what's the significance of the number 23?
That was something else. It was being illuminated by 23 enormous stars. I've been trying to ponder that myself, and I haven't really come up with any associations with the number 23 that made any sense to me yet.
And how many seals were there on the Dark One's prison? Were there 13?
13, yeah. There were 13. Oh, wait.
Is it the 13 plus
no,
the
no,
10?
No, 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 no,
no. No, no, no.
There were seven.
There were seven seals.
Four we know are broken, and three we don't know for sure.
That's right.
We think they still remain. There were seven.
So is there some number that would be 13 plus 10 that would make sense? 13 Forsaken plus? I'm just trying to come up with something that would equate to 23, because 23 is so specific in this instance.
Right. Well, numerologically, I think 23 is pretty significant in, now I can't remember. Is it Kabbalah? I mean, 23 is kind of an important mystical number, but I can't remember exactly the associations. It's been too long.
It occurs to me that 23 also appears somewhere else in the book, as opposed to just in that one instance with the 23 stars, and I don't remember where it was. It seemed like there were a number of weird number combinations in this book. Like there was a discussion in Avienda's future memories that seemed to be connected to, like, it seemed to be like a clan thing, but it seemed like the number was also really odd there too.
And the other thing that struck me about that was, and it's really easy to skip by that part and just go right to the crystal being shattered, but they were not only 23 stars, but they were 23 enormous or very large stars. And I wonder what the significance of that is. Why would it need to be illuminated by 23 enormous stars? I think enormous was the word. I don't remember now.
No, that's right. It's an enormous sphere made up of the finest crystal and sparkling in the light of 23 enormous stars.
That's two enormouses. There must be some significance to it, but I confess I'm at a loss to think what that might be at this moment in time.
I have no idea.
There's a reference about Daughters of Silence. The Daughters of Silence were two accepted who had been put out of the tower, and 23 women they had gathered and trained.
Hmm. Well,
so
that's an obscure reference.
It's a very obscure reference. Yeah. It comes from the glossary of Crossroads of Twilight. And again, during the history of the White Tower over 3,000 years, this is one of the groups that was put out, and they were the Daughters of Silence.
Found that there were 23 of them. That's specific.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure what the reference point is, unless, again, it has to do with breaking the White Tower itself, or some piece about the tower, and you know, the crystal itself representing more than just sort of the nations of the earth or the seals or any of it, but breaking in a sense the tower as well.
I just assumed it was the Dark One's prison. Now, why that would be something so beautiful isn't clear to me, but I believe the Dark One's prison that Rand saw the boar drilled into in the array, something like a pearly white egg-shaped thing, was strangely enough floating in the sky over one of these cities, and he saw the little dark flame come to it and a little chip spin off of it and go shooting into the air, and he thought to himself, did I really just see the boar being drilled into the Dark One's prison? And that's what the sphere immediately reminded me of, was the Sharoam. or the Sharome, or whatever. I'm not sure how you pronounce that.
But Virginia, I think your theory is good, because again, this idea that there were cracks already in the crystal itself would seem to imply the seals breaking, right? In a sense, the crystal itself falling apart is an indication of the progress of the whole thing breaking down.
And Rand's determination to break that seal in order to break the Dark One.
Yeah.
So that he can clear the rubble and repatch it anew. I like what he said to Egwene, that, you know, you couldn't patch the patch. The patch had to be removed so that it could be sealed again.
Right.
And he said that specifically to her when he met her.
Well, I'm also happy that, you know, at some point, I think Perrin hears about the plan. He's like, well, yeah, that makes sense.
He did. Yeah. Right. I liked the way Perrin worded it as well. About forging, when you're, you know, if you're going to make a sword, if there's a sword that's broken, you don't, you make a new blade, you know? You have to break it and reforge it completely new.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, well, it is. It's a direct kind of reference towards the idea of all of these mystical swords in literature, and the most famous being Narsil being reforged into Andariel in Lord of the Rings. Where rather than making a new sword, you reforge it out of the old one. And now the issue there is that in all of the, well, not all, but in many of those cases, when you have a mystical sword that's been broken and reforged and made stronger, it literally is because that sword was magical to begin with. And real time, you know, the idea is the seals on the Dark One's prison they're blocking the way. They're a temporary stopgap. They are the ropes that are holding the prison together, which is why, you know, Rand has to cut the ropes away. And
well, and isn't the sword that's broken and made whole again almost an image of Rand himself here?
Well, yeah,
right. I mean, that's part of what we see in sort of the shining nature of who Rand becomes.
Right, and he did say to Egwene that he was broken and been reforged.
It almost calls to mind, in some ways, the Fisher King image as well. Sort of the myth of the Fisher King who has to be wounded, in a sense, to bring about change.
Right.
And we know the Fisher plays a pretty significant role in the Wheel of Time mythology as well. I mean, Rand has become the Fisher on a number of occasions in various different ways.
Oh, we move on from, you know, the Nisana one, and then obviously the one with Rand, which we assume has to do with breaking the seals. But then the very first one she saw was kind of interesting. In my mind, I see it, you know, she's in this small room with being held in Gawain's arms, and then all of a sudden, everything, the walls around her, Gawain himself, just kind of crumble into dust and fall to the ground, and there's 13 massive towers on the horizon. And then you start, like Daniel read, you start seeing them fall. And the ones that are left get bigger. And, you know, there's rampant speculation on this. To my mind, it refers to the Forsaken and how when one of them falls, the others get stronger. But that's just at a first glance. And, you know, when you start to actually think about it, you're wondering, it doesn't make too much sense for that to be the Forsaken if she's just learning about it right now, or she's just dreaming about it right now, especially when you consider the fact that that the Forsaken have been out since the Eye of the World, or the Great Hunt, and she's been dreaming since the dragon, the Shadow Rising, at the very least. I think she might have even had some dreams before that, but the Shadow Rising, definitely she's been dreaming. But this is the first time that she's had a dream that, oh, by the way, when one of the Forsaken falls, the others get more powerful. No, really?
Well, first thing I had thought, because I originally thought that too, that it was the Forsaken, was just that it was almost giving her a tally. These are how many are left. These are how many aren't coming back. They've been fail-fired or whatnot. Kind of rethinking that as I got towards the end of the book. But my original thought was that it was letting her know that there were 6 left and that they were stronger with the fall of the other ones.
Well, and part of that, and this is where I wonder, I mean, if we stay with the idea that the towers are the Forsaken, there is the possibility that it, in some ways, it is a slight tally. You know, this is how many you're going to be facing. But at the same time, it's very specific about one of the towers being crumbled almost nearly to the ground and then looming above all of the others. And it seems that that would be a very specific, that one of the Forsaken fell very, very low, and then they, you know, surpassed and went up. And I don't know if that's supposed to be, you know, a, oh, hey, by the way, Ishii became Moradin kind of confirmation, or if it's supposed to mean, like, maybe Mogedion or Lanthier or any of the others rise to more prominence after their subsequent humiliating defeats, which most of the Forsaken have experienced.
Yeah, we have several Forsaken that have fallen really low. We see Lanthier being, well, as Sindane being basically tortured over and over again. Mithana is very much out of favor and presumably been abused by Shadar Haran quite thoroughly. Grendel was the one. Mithana is not in favor. I mean, they're all basically, except for Demondred. We don't see Demondred at all, I don't think, really.
Mithana's now a drooling idiot.
Oh, that's right. Mithana's a drooling idiot. Sorry, I'm losing it. Yeah,
well, you can't get much lower than a drooling idiot.
She's done. Grendel may come back. I mean, Mogedion got over her Shadar Haran experience.
The six count, I don't... Is there six left? I don't think there are at the end of the book, are there?
Yep.
There were at the time of her dream, so never mind. Yeah, there were six.
Yeah, okay. Well, because Mithana isn't technically
Mithana was number six, basically.
She's not
so
dead. She's like
left.
Brain dead. She's like a vegetable.
Well, yeah, but when Egwene had this dream, there were six.
Yeah.
So there's only five left at the end of the book, though.
But can the Dark One bring her back from that? She's not dead, but can he heal her if he wanted to?
Going on the fact that Ishamiel was able to heal Lusthaeran of the madness for a little bit, I would be surprised if there wasn't some form of healing that could... Oh, probably Nynaeve could even do it. She seems to be becoming the neurosurgeon of the age. That there was some healing that she could do to fix the brain. The thing is, I don't think that anyone's going to. Mithana messed up too badly for any of the dark friends or the to want her back. And none of the light friends need her. Egwene won't allow it. After what happened, like she flexed in the epilogue? In one of the later chapters in the Towers of Midnight, but in Gathering Storm, you know, she made the mistake with Maw Keaton of keeping her around, trying to use her for information. And because she kept her around, she was able to escape, and one of the Forsaken was let loose again on the world. And so I don't think she would allow that to happen again.
I don't think so either. And I think she was thinking of what they were going to do with Danelle Mithana, now that she's a drooling idiot.
Yeah.
But one thing that maybe you discussed this while I was out of reception area, one thing that I have to bring up that to me that seems like a really obvious interpretation, and I like that, and that would be my first thought. But the thing that keeps bothering me about this, and forgive me if you've already brought this up, but the 13 towers, there actually are 13 towers of Midnight in Seanchan. They are described very clearly in the book, and that just seems like too much of a coincidence that she dreams about these towers when they're supposed to refer to the Forsaken, but there actually are 13 towers like that,
and they're called the Towers of Midnight.
And they're called the Towers of Midnight, which the book is named for. So they have to have
them. Well, and then in the Dark Prophecy, you know, they have the Midnight Towers. So, you know, I would not be... Well, we already know that much of the founding of Shandar was influenced by Ishamael.
Right, yeah.
And so I would not be surprised if that's something that he had said or maybe a prominent dark friend had done or something. I have no idea.
Well, I mean, also when you consider it, I mean, ravens and crows are, you know, major spy animals for the Dark One. And yes, you know, it's the Court of Ravens.
Yeah.
I mean,
I love that one. Well, yeah, it just seems like even though we know that they are not all dark friends, I mean, obviously they did have some high place dark friends, but Tuon, I assume, Tuon and Seleucia, which are basically the highest ranked members of their society right now, are not dark friends. So much influence from Ishamael during the course of their, well, starting with Luthair, Pendrag, and up from there, that, you know, they have the ability to be a strong tool for the Dark Friends, for the Great Lord and Ishamael, and sowing seed and sowing chaos in the world.
And poor Matt, now named the Prince of the Ravens.
Yeah, I cannot wait to see what powers he is grant, what you know, political powers he is granted as Prince of the Ravens. I love the thought from Fortuato. Like, well, it might be nice to have a Prince of the Ravens who is always trying to kill me.
Yeah, so here's my Prince of the Ravens. He's my cupbearer. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's Taco Bell, no problem.
Yeah.
The other question about the towers, right, is you know, and it, the math doesn't quite work, so it would need some stretching in some way. But there are 14 lands in Randland, 14 powers or political powers in Randland, right? If I look at my map and count, is there some way to recount this based on who's standing and who's not that would allow, in a sense, Shanchan to be the tower that falls and then raises?
Hmm.
Is this a political picture rather than a Forsaken picture?
Hmm.
Well, in your count of 14, are you tying Andor and Carian together?
No, I'm not. So that's actually a really interesting question. If you
tie, if they become ruled by the same queen, then they might become one land in essence, even though different
names. That's what she's trying to do. Yeah.
Right.
So there are 14 if you can't count Andor and Carian separately. If you combine them, it's 13.
And Tarvalon, wow. You're considering its own power, I'm assuming.
No, I'm not counting Tarvalon. I'm looking at
counting just actual nations rather than all the little city states like Carmon.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
That's almost too good to be true.
Yeah.
I almost would think that'd be a red herring if it was anything, but I can't dismiss it. One thing I wanted to bring up really quickly when we touched on Chen and Fortuana, may she live forever, there was that little aside by Grendel, who was thinking to herself that now that Semirag has been killed, she had made some effort to tie some strings to the child empress of the Shanchan, and I thought, I wonder where that went and how much she got done with that.
Right. I was thinking
that. What's going on with that plot, you know?
Yeah, that's a good question.
She had been the one who influenced her, you know, to stand against the Dragon Reborn at
right.
the first meeting, you know, and ignore his plea for peace.
Well, that wouldn't require much at the first meeting. Rand was kind of a little
psycho.
I don't think.
Well, yeah, darkness warping around him. I guess that would kind of freak anybody out. But.
Yeah, I don't think there was anything he could have done, there's anything he could have done that would have, at that time, in the mindset he was in, that would have properly brought about the peace. But slipping forward several chapters to Avienda's viewing, Avienda's second trip through the last Colin Tarangriel, you know, we know that somehow or another there's Rand gets this piece of the dragons going with all the nations and the earth and the Shanchan. And so I have
Yeah, we know
wondered,
how that worked out.
Yeah.
Well, that's like obvious, it comes right out and says it. The only reason that the Aiel fall is because Rand has no idea what to do with them. And so he doesn't subject them to the peace of the dragon. And so they're like, okay, what do we do? Let's make a war with the Shanchan. Yes. And so it just degenerates from there.
Well, and I mean, what that shows is that the idea of, you know, a world peace between the nations is possible. I really do think it's just avoiding certain key decisions that, you know, leads to so much estrangement and awkwardness. I mean, I was really surprised considering that, you know, Elaine and Avienda are first sisters. I mean, they think, you know, like one of the grandkids thinks something about, you know, oh, well, you know, just because, you know, our great mothers were first sisters, you know, and there's like, there was so much separation between,
yeah,
the children, and it seemed really odd that would happen.
Yeah.
And we're obviously missing some very key things, particularly also what happened to Rand, because they don't say he died. They say he left. And I mean, it's almost like a transcendence. Like he just, you know, is taken bodily up into the creator, and that's it.
He did a Daniel Jackson.
Well, it sounded less like that to me than more like, you know, he retires into hermitage and just leaves the world to be. You know, I've influenced enough. I've torn it apart and put it back together and done all the stuff that I've done in the last couple of years. I'm going away, and you ain't never going to see from me again because I don't like this anymore.
Oh, I like the Daniel Jackson thing better. I want to see him ascend in the white light, and you know, then he can kind of peek through and sort of nag people now and again when the time is right, you know.
Because like his children don't mention, you know, Avienda's, you know, and Rand's children don't mention, oh well, we should try to find him. It was always just he's gone. Oh, well, next.
Yeah.
Well, when they said that, I thought of him leaving like Frodo. Like, just kind of, you know.
Stands on a ship.
Right.
Rand is gone to be with the heroes of the horn. Oh, well.
Oh, no, he hops on a ship out of Ilion and goes to the Isle of the Mad Men.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Takes men with him. Because she can't travel, even though Avienda and Elaine can, so they can go visit whenever.
Well, and that's another bizarre part, is that, you know, you don't hear... I mean, like, in those future memories, or whatever they are, we kind of get that Fortuana rules for a while, and something happens to her, which eventually makes the Peace of the Dragon impossible.
Well, there was a nice piece there, Andrew, talking about that, where there's a mention made of, especially with Damane and Sodom, that there was almost a resolution.
Yeah.
Right. If you remember, there's a line, it's familiar because I think I read it about an hour ago. There's a line that talks about, you know, that under the previous emperor, so the emperor before, there was a chance at solving this issue.
Yeah, and then we don't get any further resolution as to what happened to the old empress, and you know, to change things over, and then
her mother did not live forever.
Yeah, but we didn't hear, you know, in any of those visions, we didn't hear anything about Nynaeve, who you would figure would be a rather prominent figure. You don't hear anything really about Elaine at all. Or Avienda, just that they existed.
Yeah.
Right, history.
I mean, even Ruark becomes a kind of, you know, pseudo-mythical figure in just one to two generations. It's like, you know, oh, it was Ruark. And he is. He's like this iconic sort of figure who just isn't present anymore. And, like, nobody... There were no little tiny details that the memory would bring up. Oh, yes, so-and-so died in blank a blank.
Right. I have to tell you, that whole scene kind of was too Doom-like for me in a lot of ways. It really bothered me.
Yeah, it was kind of dark. But going back to what you were saying, Andrew, you got to think, though, that this is from an ideal mindset, and they wouldn't think a lot about Wetlander history. You know, where all these Wetlander historical figures that ended up, their historical figures are Ruark, who was one of the great clan chiefs, the Kar Karn a little bit, in so much that his children are revered.
He was her father, Rand, and you would think that
the other children that were fathered by him,
especially Elaine's children, Elaine and Rand's children, you would think that there would be fondness or love or something.
The second generation, Avienda's granddaughter, was crazy. One generation removed, it was weird because they didn't think of themselves as Avienda's children or Rand's children. They were the children of the dragon. That kind of mindset wouldn't lend itself, because they're almost legends in their own right. I mean, they're channeling constantly.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess,
power.
We were talking about
Well, no, they weren't actually channeling constantly, but they were always.
Well, no, they were holding.
They were
power
tapped into the source, or they didn't.
Yeah.
They didn't have to, like how everybody else has to kind of embrace the source or.
Yeah, they were always
let it go.
Holding the
they
power.
They were just always.
Right.
It was always on, basically.
Yeah.
It was always on. Which we were talking about this, Daniel and I and everybody that was on the Midnight Release chat. We were doing a lot of talking about what could be the thing that's odd about Abby and his quadruplets, the four of them, right?
Well, I thought that was it, yeah.
And yeah, so I think that's it. So we kind of at least figured, actually we got a lot of closures in this for things that we've been theorizing for years.
Well, I don't know.
Those kids are too doing-like for me. I'm sorry. They're like,
well, I don't know. I don't know if, I don't, to me that doesn't sit right. I don't think that fits with men's viewing of the
really?
Four of them at once. Something, well, that I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the actual book in front of me, but it's something like, Avienda would have children too. Four of them at once. There was something odd about them, but still.
They would be healthy.
No, it was like they would all be healthy, but something odd.
Yeah.
Well, it's the odd piece.
But, okay, I gotta look it up. I go into Encyclopedia Walt now. But in my mind, the odd that she was referring to was referring less to the children and more to, or less about, oh, I don't know.
But hold on. If the answer is that they've been channeling, or not channeling, but holding the power since birth, wouldn't that be odd?
That's odd
well,
to me, yeah. I mean, they basically came out of the womb and were channeling. Like, that's the impression I got.
Yeah, it says, obviously.
Boy, that could be scary.
Here's the,
really,
here's the wording, though. Here's the wording, though, that, and this is why I think it has something more to do with before they're born, and less to do with the fact that they're, says, Avienda would have Ransavi 2, four of them at once. Something was odd about that, though. The babies would be healthy, but still something odd. It seems to me like it's not referring to the state the children are in, but to my mind, it refers more to the way they were conceived.
Having quadruplets is not common in the first place, but I just have to disagree with you on that. I think it's referring to their inborn ability to channel from birth and hold the power at all times and never have to release it. That is as odd as anything I've heard. It's never happened that we know of in the Age of Legends or the age that Rand lives in or anything even written. No one's ever even mentioned that as a possibility.
No.
So that's plenty odd to me. Singular, certainly. But that's just my opinion.
Now, would they get that special ability from Rand because of his newfound powers or whatever?
His newfound godhood, practically?
Yeah.
You mean? I
because
don't know.
Obviously, Avienda conceived after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Them, so I'm wondering if maybe it's something or not, but...
I don't know.
To me, that's odd.
Question.
I don't know. That's very odd, and nobody, as far as we know, there hasn't been anybody born like that. So the fact that all four of them were, to me, that's just...
What I would be interested to hear is whether or not Elaine's twins have the same thing. Because if it's from Rand, if it's because of Rand, then Elaine's children will have it too. But if it's because of Avienda...
Hers were conceived in Winter's Far, right? So it was way before Rand's epiphany and his, like, godliness.
Yeah.
His new powers and all that. Like, what I'm saying is, if it's from Rand after he got all these new...
Yeah, but I don't think those would affect
powers.
His...
Yeah, abilities.
I don't know if it would affect his DNA or not, but...
Yeah, I don't think that it would affect his seed that much. What happened to him on Dragonmount seems more to be a mental thing. You know, his mind, like it said, he was broken. His mind was broken, shattered into so many different pieces. And finally he was able to rectify them all together, to form one cohesive whole.
I mean, another show, we haven't seen children of both parents who can channel before, have we?
Yeah, I think we
not,
have.
Not in this age.
Yeah, they talked several times about certain different Aes Sedai who had born children by a man who could channel, or and then a queen, I think, so forth. But I think it has happened, it's just not common. The other thing that's uncommon about them is to have four siblings who can all channel.
Right.
Because it seems to be not 100% inherited genetically. I mean, it was remarked that it was really astonishing that, Talon, the Seafolk apprentice, was like the third generation of channelers in her family. I mean, you know, apparently the more common scenario is that one child out of a family might pop up channeling. Rarely does it happen where more than one does. So it's apparently quite a recessive and not that common. So for four of them all to be channelers, that's odd in itself. I don't know if that's enough to be considered odd, but...
Well, I think the combination makes it odd enough to be men's viewing anyway.
I personally cannot imagine the agony of raising four children who can channel from birth.
Have you guys ever watched Charmed?
Oh, my God. Like, the terrible twos aren't bad enough
Have you ever watched
channeling.
Have you ever watched Charmed, where the baby's always, like, disappearing because he can do all this stuff and he's, like, the little baby Wyatt, he's always making things happen. He makes a dragon appear, and he's going one place, then another, and oh my gosh, I couldn't imagine. I think I go crazy right now.
That would certainly be difficult and stressful.
That would be.
And what age do they start opening their own little gateways, you know? Bye, Mom!
Yeah.
Well, and evidently you can open a gateway and use it as a pair of scissors, too.
Right.
Well, if you're talented like Andral, you can open one the size of a postage stamp. You know, how cool is that?
And hey, what did I say in earlier podcast? You know, honestly, best mail delivery system ever.
Yeah. It works well for the box and Kleenex, too, and it's a lot less energy than opening a Stargate. Yeah.
It definitely beats the Bela Express.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question you've raised, Virginia. Can you travel to another planet?
I suppose, if you where you were going.
Yeah.
It seems like it might be easier to do it with a portal stone, but...
Well, those are mirror worlds, not other planets.
Did you guys, when we were... when Avienda went through the first time, were you waiting to hear the song? Because I was. I'm always...
Thought she'd discover the song.
I did! I was kind of disappointed in that one. I thought she'd find a clue, at least, or something.
She's not a Jeff Beal. She's not a Pinker, so she ain't never find the song, sorry.
No, I know.
The Pinkers are never going to find the song. It's gone.
Was anyone else upset that all we heard from Loyal was the little foreword at the beginning?
I know,
I had
the song on my iPod, but then I deleted it by mistake.
Oh, Virginia.
I'm sorry. It was on the hard drive that crashed, right?
what is the comment that Avienda makes? What does it mean when she says something about the fact that she remembered her children's faces from her first visit to Rydian? Do we see that? I don't remember
We never actually saw that. No.
We didn't see her.
But the only thing, the rings that you pass through in Rydian the first time, and when you become an apprentice wise one, you see your life in many variations. And so it is possible that she would have seen at least a young adult version of her children's faces.
The only things that we know that she remembered seeing was when she told Elaine that they shouldn't go when he's cleansing the tape, because she remembered that there was some reason why she should not, but it wasn't clear. It was just a warning in her mind that she had picked up. And then we knew that she had seen that she was going to be tied to Randall Thor, which is what made her so darn crabby for that whole couple of books.
Yeah.
She didn't want any part of him.
I'm trying to remember her reaction to the four children, though. Because what's interesting is the reveal here is that she knew she was going to have the four children. That's how I read this, at least. Or at least she had seen them in Rydian.
Yeah.
So she shouldn't have been surprised by men's viewing.
Well, maybe it was just a possibility, and she wasn't sure, you know, if that was her path. I don't know.
You're right, because there is a reference that those have been possibilities.
Right.
Yeah, not only that, but maybe I'm losing it because I'm kind of tired, but was she already an apprentice wild and had gone through the rings when Min revealed that?
Yeah.
Didn't she go after that?
No.
No, she went right at the beginning
she
of Shadow Rising.
Yeah. She was book four or five. Yeah, book four, I guess. And then Shadow Rising.
Okay.
And then Min had her viewing about the babies when Elaine and Rand were getting it on.
There are a lot of, to your point earlier, there are a lot of questions answered, but those questions almost seem to, you know, begin more questions.
Right.
More
there's,
questions.
We have
those
more
answers
than what
more
we started
questions.
With. Yeah, I know. We figured out who people were that we've been speculating on, like Miss Anna.
Well, and who killed Esmo.
Who killed Asmodian. We found out that Noel was Jane, right?
Called that one.
And I kind of figured, which I just thought it. Yeah, I know this, but who Gadel Kane was, but I guess maybe it wasn't as open and shut as I thought it was.
Yeah. Well, you know what I found interesting about a lot of these reveals is that they were like tossaways just in a sentence. They were like, Egwene's
right.
thinking about this and this, and oh, by the way, they found this on it. It was Delana, and
right.
then she's thinking about something else and else. And it's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
So
but it was nice because it's something that we've talked about, and I've had that for years, you know, and some of these are things that we've, it's just nice to have confirmation on that.
So do we want to review them? Because, you know, again, I don't know that people will have necessarily caught them on the first read through.
That's true. That's a good idea. Let's do that.
I had mentioned that, you know, the Who Killed Asmodian piece. I know many people have pointed to the glossary or the end of the book, but there's a reference actually early on. It happens in the chapter called Writings, where Grendel's summoned to meet with Morden, and Morden says something about, you know why I've summoned you, and Grendel says, I do, and Morden says, Arengar's dead, lost to us, and after the Great Lord transmigrated her soul the last time, one might think you're making a habit of this sort of thing, Grendel. The implication, of course, that Grendel's had others killed before. And then it goes on to say, Morden says, surely you do not imply that Arengar has turned traitor. Again, the implication here being that Grendel's action was to silence Asmodian because he had become a traitor to the Great Lord. That was the piece that sort of clued me into, oh, now I get it. But it wasn't as obvious, perhaps, as others might have wanted it to be.
Yeah, you know, the only place that it actually came out and said it was in the glossary, which was absolutely...
Right, it did come right out and say that. I thought that the part at the end where Shadar Heron, was speaking to her, and he said that she was responsible for the death of Three Forsaken, that seemed... pretty obvious. I didn't catch it till then. That's when I caught it. I completely missed the first one that you were just talking about, Daniel.
Yeah. I'll admit, I skipped to the glossary to read it. And then,
you did?
I did.
When
I
you were reading
weak.
The...
I read the glossary first. But,
spoiler-fied.
Yeah. And it told me about Miss Anna, too. And I was like, oh, so Miss Anna is going to be captured in this book. That's good. But, you know, and so I was kind of looking for it when I read through the book, and I didn't see it in the first one at all. Even though you're right, you're right, Daniel. It was kind of right there.
Kerry, what was your reference about who is Gadel Kane? Could you describe sort of where you found that and why you figured that?
In my mind, it was just kind of obvious, which I guess I could be wrong because it seems like. I haven't really heard much about it, but basically, in Perrin's point of view, and he's talking to Grady, and he says something to him about, I don't have my book here, so I can't, but he does say something about him wanting to get back to his family, I think, and he mentioned something about his beautiful son, or his something about his good-looking boy, and he mentions, Grady says, he's as pretty as a stump, or something. To references that. And I know it's just something completely simple. It doesn't really say that that's Gadel Kane, but he was Grady. It was mentioned back in Lord of Chaos at the Black Tower that he had a small son. I was thinking he was maybe an infant or a toddler, and Gadel Kane went missing from the world of dreams, according to Brigida, in Fires of Heaven, I believe. And so it's been speculated that he couldn't be as old as Oliver, because RJ says that was impossible. but that he could be an infant or a young boy. So I'm thinking younger than five. So it kind of, to me, it just jumped out at me and said, it jumped out at me enough that I actually posted on my Goodreads account, I know who Gaynell Cain is. I was so excited because it seemed very obvious to me. But then after speaking with other people, yeah, and the rest of you, it seemed like maybe I was jumping the gun. But I stand by it. I think that that's who. Yeah, his name is Virginia.
Oh, just a second.
Here.
I'm trying to.
Is she still here?
Yeah, I'm looking it up. I'm in the right spot.
Gadrin. Yeah, Gadrin, I think his name is.
Yeah, the reference is Gadrin. Let's see. Grady nodded, glancing at the sky as a low rumble of thunder came from the north. I just want to talk to her, you know, and I need to see the little Gadrin again. I won't recognize the lad. I'm sure he's a handsome child, Grady. Grady laughed. It felt odd, but good to hear that from the man. Handsome? Gadrin? My lord. He might be big for his age, but he's about as pretty as a stump. Still, I love him something fierce. But yeah, the Gadrin connection, Gadrin to Gaidal. Is not too big a jump, but also, you're right. See, it's Lord of Chaos where it says that they have a young son, but yeah. it never gives an age, but you're right. The time might just be right. Obviously, the king is going to be over 2 years old, probably even under that, because we saw Gaidal Cain in Teleron Rial in the book series, and the book series only covers 2 years. But that doesn't mean that he's not. It does say that he's big for his age, so we don't know.
Well, I'm not sure what kind of significance he's going to have, because the thing that's odd about that, or I guess even if he was spun out as any infant or child at this point in time, is that it's said that the Heroes of the Horn are spun out when they're needed, and we were assuming that he'd be needed for the last battle. But if he's a child, what can he do? So I was wondering if, since his father is an Ashaman, and actually Virginia pointed out that since his father can channel, that maybe he would be able to as well this time around. So maybe he becomes a leader in the future because we know that even though the last battle's over, that there's still war going on. So maybe he is important in that way. I don't know.
Yeah, the last battle done, but the world not done with battle.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know. It was something that, I guess it's my crazy theory, but that's what I think.
Well, we know that Gaidal Cain has to be a child, and that's a scary thought, because the wheel would have to weave him out far enough in advance that he would be able to be, you know, old enough to actually be of some use in whatever it was the wheel needed in. And that's obviously not the last battle.
Right.
But that's frightening to consider, because the only other things that we've seen that hint at battles after that is Avienda's viewing with the huge battle with the Seanchan. And we know that there is absolutely no way to beat the Seanchan as long as they have Damani. Because the Damani are overpowered. They're too powerful. They are massive weapons and you cannot beat them.
Right.
And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, they had some form of, or they had the domination bands for men as well. If they use the domination bands on male channelers, or maybe just kill them outright, but I doubt they would do that.
Whole scenario with Avienda seeing her future in the Seanchan, that just freaked me right out.
Oh yeah, it was scary. It was frightening. I could only enjoy it so far, and as much as it scared the pants off of me for the future of the world, because honestly, as much as I kind of like Fortuana, kind of, simply because of her connection to Nat, you know, there's so much about the Seanchan culture as a whole that I cannot like.
They have slaves. I mean, that's not, I mean, not even to mention what they do with women that can channel. They have slaves. I mean, I just, you know, I can't.
Yeah, the entire hierarchy is just way out of whack.
Right. They need, something needs to have to be done with that. And I was thinking when it was mentioned in Avienda's, when she went through the rings the second time, that Rand had bowed to the Crystal Throne. Or, isn't that what it says?
It wouldn't surprise me at all. To my mind, there's just not enough time before the last battle. Well, there's not enough time. The last battle is upon the world right now at the end of this book.
Right.
And so there's not enough time for Rand to do anything politically and scheming in order to get the Shanshan to join him. So the fastest, the best, the most direct way to get the Shanshan armies involved in the last battle is to say, okay, whatever, I'm going to bow to you now. We're going to fight the last battle, and then you're going to do what I tell you to.
But at the end of, from what I'm thinking, is that when she did get to see her future, it's like, it's not set in stone. I think it's very much like when she went through to be an apprentice, that it is things that could possibly happen. So maybe by way of her warning Rand, there are certain things he might be able to do to change that. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Didn't they say that a lot of the problem was that because the Empress had died, right? So basically Tuan or Fortuana, something happens to her, and the new Empress doesn't need to, they don't need to follow the dragon's peace because he didn't make that with them.
The problem to my mind wasn't that that Fortuana had died. You know, the problem more seemed to be the fact that the Aiel didn't have anything to do. The dragon didn't know what to do with them, and so he just left them. Yeah, he didn't know what to do with them, and so he just left them. And then you see all the entire war is started with a few of the Aiel saying, you know, I want to fight. And so they start fighting, and then the next generation, they bring the rest of the nations in on their fight, and it's just...
So is this the purpose of Aviana going through the rings? I mean, again, not to overstate the obvious, but is the idea here, again, what's unclear to me is whether this is the possible future or the definitive future. And I would like to think, although Aviana questions it herself, I would like to think that it is a possible future. And in a sense, Aviana will be the one to either take control of the Aiel or provide some direction for Rand for the Aiel to actually, you know, again, to avert this possible future.
Well, to make sure that he doesn't exclude them, that he has a purpose for them. The Aiel, I think it's pretty obvious that they just can't go back to the way things were before they left the Waste. Things have to change. Everybody's going to change after the last battle. It's just inevitable. But then again, I thought, well, what if they were included in the peace? But do I want the Shanshan to rule the whole nation? Not really. Not with the way that they are.
Well, is that also inevitable?
Even if it's peaceful.
Right. Is that also an inevitability, or is that frankly something that needs to be resolved as well?
Something that she can change because it's a possible future, or is it the future and it's like self fulfilling prophecy where because she tries to change it, it actually happens from something that she does. You know, we don't know. I certainly hope not. Certainly hope that there's a way around this so that when a memory like ends, that we're not worrying about this because that would
maybe it's sort of a quantum thing because you looked at it and you changed it.
Right.
She collapsed the wave function, so that's not going to happen now.
All a portion of Randinger's Grom.
Yeah. I love it.
So we know who Carrie thinks is Gaedle Kane. What did you think about the reveal of who's been Masana? Was that a surprise? Danelle was such a sort of a nothing character.
I've had Danelle from the beginning. That was,
yeah.
There were too many.
I've had her.
She was in the area when all the she was just in the area too many times, and she was solitary with no friends. She would have been easy to take over or impersonate one of the two. So yeah, that was a big.
And there were a lot of actual traits of hers. I think there was something in particular. I don't even remember what it is. This is so long ago.
Well, I don't know. Just tapping the lips or
right.
Or
there's something that she did that was mentioned about Masana doing as well. So it was very obvious. That was one of the most obvious for just kind of, I think a lot of us, or at least I did, I just assumed that we knew that was her. But it was nice to have the confirmation on it as well. But
yeah, I was pretty sure. I mean, I would have been surprised if it had been someone else, but you never know. You know, she could have been a red herring. There's lots of that.
That's true. Yeah.
Speaking of red herrings, were you surprised that Grendel survived into this book?
I actually know. Kind of have two minds about that. I thought it was just too large of a coincidence the way it happened. And at first glance, I said, yeah, I'm really going to miss her. I wish she hadn't died. But then I kind of thought, that is just too convenient. And I thought, you know what?
Yeah,
she could have got a way around that. I think I even said that in one of the podcasts. I think she could have.
Yeah.
She could have found some way to get around that. And I think we all kind of agreed that that was a distinct possibility.
Mm-hmm. I was the opposite. I thought at first that it was just too easy and that there's no way she'd be gone. And then for whatever reason, I started thinking afterward that she was. I'm not sure why, but yeah, so I was actually shocked.
But I didn't get the Arengar and Delana getting toasted at the same time. That was a nice little twist that I had no clue on that one.
I was sitting the fence on Grendel because it was one of those things where, you know, I was using the direct evidence we were given. There was compulsion in the brain beforehand. There wasn't compulsion in the brain afterwards. And mm-hmm. we knew Grendel was in Natron's Barrow. I mean, we knew she was there. So it was like, it only made sense that, well, if the compulsion was gone, either she's got a really fancy way of getting rid of compulsion, or I can't see how it was done. And so at the instant that, you know, we're seeing Grendel in the palace and Arengar's there, it's like, oh, okay, if Arengar's there, that means Delana's there. That means there can be female compulsion in the brain.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, and the first time I heard it was, you know, the pre-release when I actually got the audio from Virginia. And I was listening to it during a car ride, and it's like, this is from Grendel's point of view. This is right before, oh man, she survived. But, you know, you know, beyond the fact that she survives, what do you guys think of the fact that, you know, we now know that there's a special weave of the true power that they actually use to have birds as spies?
Right. It's not just the dark, like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we knew that they
could
were
use spies. Them as spies.
And
but
that,
we never
but,
saw
and that
how
they
it...
had to go and report. Well, I kind of had the idea that, you know, they had to go and report, but, you know, the idea that they're actually can
right.
be used as eyes and ears.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That is just a little creepy. You know, I mean, think
a little.
I'd be sitting around, you know, I guess none of the people of the light, I guess you could say, they don't actually know about this weave. But if I did and I was like Egwene or any of the rest, I'd be sitting in my room wondering if there's any, you know, rats or anything staring at me.
I like the little aside that she thought to herself that she wished she had had an owl, which would have been better for it, but she chided herself for not having one captive. I thought that was maybe a nice little throwaway to the Harry Potter owls.
We're the Futurama.
Yeah. We're owl exterminators.
As long as no one delivers a howler.
Oh, my God. Oh, I think probably Grendel got one of those.
So that was Varin's letter. Varin's letter was a howler or a screamer,
oh
or whatever they were called.
Oh.
With the red sealing wax, absolutely. That's why that didn't want to open it. He knew it was a howler. you needed somebody to tell him, don't put it off. They just get worse.
Well, and this one did.
I know, and it. Oh, I was just kicking myself after reading, you know, after reading Varin's letter to Matt that he did not open it sooner. Like. How could he just... I know he's stubborn, but really?
What a doof.
Oh, man.
I was annoyed more at myself because I was like, well, good. Matt got all the way through without opening Varin's letter, and so whatever strings you were going to tie to him, they aren't tied, even though it probably would have been something, you know, kind of not important, you know, something... Oh, yeah. Oh, crap.
That was... probably one of the most upsetting things out of the whole book for me.
Yeah.
It really, I know it's a city, you know, it's not a person or anything, but I, wow, I just, that's
I know, it's
away.
Like, gee, thanks, Matt. You know, you would have to put your foot down on this one.
Yeah,
any
really.
Other time you would have, any other time you would have had that thing open and found some way to get around both, you know.
Well, but I mean, at the same time, too, Varin really misjudged Matt on that one.
Yeah,
the letter specifically said, oh, I figured you'd you'd be able to wait maybe a day or two, and it's like, well.
And, you know, as much as everybody knows that he can't, not that he can't stand Aes Sedai, but he doesn't want any strings tied to him and that he doesn't want to be involved in their politics, you'd think that maybe she would have told him, gave him different instructions. I don't
know. Well, you know, she was basically dealing, I mean, she hadn't seen Matt really in a long time. She was basically dealing with what she remembered of the old Matt, and that's
right.
All a lot. He's changed a lot. He's probably changed.
And she had to
Rand.
I was thinking she had to give him the instructions like that because she couldn't give away any secrets until after she was dying.
Right.
Right? At least that's how I took it. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why she
had that was her oath. Yeah, that was a black
word it that way. So as long as it was after she was to die, then I guess, or in the hour that she was dying, then he could open it. But I guess she figured that he just would open it sooner anyway.
But Virginia, you raise an interesting question also, which is the question of the characters growing and, you know, in a sense, maturing. There's a lot of that that takes place as well. You see it. I see it in Elaine. I see it in, well, we had a large POV from Elaine last book, but I see it in Matt, I see it in Perrin. I mean, the Perrin resolution is beautiful in many ways. Yay!
Yeah. Yes, I actually like Perrin again.
Finally.
Thank you.
I know, I put that on Brandon's Facebook page. I said, thank you, Brandon, I can finally like Perrin again.
Yeah.
And even Morghese actually has some real growth as a character in this. I really like the direction that the characters are heading. Although there's more to do, I really like the growth and the sort of movement. You know, for a series that has taken this long, there's actually a lot of growth that's reflected in just this one book.
Oh, yeah. Well, and for one thing, we've gotten rid of almost all of the emo characters. I mean, I always point to Gowan and Perrin as being the big emo boys, but, you know, there were a lot of whiners, Fael and Morghese and, you know,
yeah.
We basically kicked a lot of them in the pants and made them man up a little bit, too.
Yeah.
Well, and the Gowan Perrin resolution was also beautifully handled. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk more about that sort of in another time, but I thought that was beautifully done as well.
When I said I think I was talking to Carrie last week earlier, the Perrin resolution is almost too good. He's now become so strong and powerful, he's almost got to die. I mean, it's a problem in high fantasy. The characters with a lot of power like that, you know, Gandalf, or I mean, they pick a series. If you give somebody special powers, it's really easy for them to become too powerful, and they have too much magic, and then you can just resolve any situation with, hey, it's magic, you know. And Brandon's a good enough author to avoid that, and so was Robert Jordan. He played the power versus character growth really well and balanced, you know, every power that everybody got had limitations that made perfect sense. So even though the Aes Sedai basically are as powerful as they are, they have all these oaths and limitations. And, you know, he did that very well. But Perrin now has become, I don't know, so wolfy and so master of Teleramriad, so much so that he can mock Egwene because she doesn't know enough.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh my gosh, this guy has become beyond awesome. Something's got to give. He's going to have to die or something's going to happen to him. That's what worries me. Because I like Perrin. I always did like Perrin until he got to be whiny.
I like Perrin up until shortly after he got married because he just...
Yeah.
Ugh.
Or actually not even married after he got, you know, involved.
Yeah, right.
She was not good for him in the beginning. Now she's grown probably as much as anybody. She has as well.
Yeah, I don't. You know, she's not one of my favorites, but I do not hate her now.
Yeah, but that maturity.
I really, really couldn't stand her before, but I actually was growing to admire her a little bit. So
yeah,
Perrin has me worried.
Well, and then we have that dark prophecy too.
Right.
You know, the fallen blacksmith, and Grendel mentioned that also. And then I don't know what the broken wolf refers to. If that's another, I don't know why they would need to have two references to Perrin.
Yeah, well, I think we were talking that time too, I thought maybe it was Hopper. But why would Hopper be in a dark prophecy? I don't know. Unless it had led to something to do with Perrin embracing who he became.
Yeah. Well,
you know, the only
the only broken wolf connection I can make in this series at all is the fact that, Perrin has been called or Perrin is supposedly, you know, somehow connected to the Wolf King, even though the wolves, their hierarchy, you know, similar to the Aiel, there's no actual king. But then also, the Crown of Saldea, which he is second in line for with his wife, is called the Broken Crown. So, that's the only connections I can make there. But you know, I think that it might be misinterpreted. The one whom death has known, or who has known death, and, okay, gotta look at it completely again.
The broken wolf, the one who death has known, and I think that, I think it's two different things.
It is, yea, the broken wolf, the one whom death has known, shall fall and be consumed by the midnight towers. I don't know, because the one whom death has known, that, to me, for some reason, makes me think of Moradin, who's not only his name is death, but also, you know, Ishamael died and came back. But it is
but he's never been
to
referred
note,
to as a wolf.
Why would he be, the broken
wolf? Yeah, but it is interesting to note that the word death is capitalized as if it were a name, which Moradin is old tongue for death.
Well, then maybe it's somebody that Moradin has actually known, if you want to get cutesy about it.
Well, yeah, the broken wolf, the one whom death has known, who's had dealings with Moradin. I don't know what broken wolf has to do with that, because really the only one we've seen with dealings with Moradin that isn't, you know, one of the chosen is Rand, but him being the broken wolf does not compute.
No, I wondered if it had some connections with the Crown of Saldea, because Gavron Bashir also has a wolf head on his baton of authority.
Yeah, and he's first in line after Tenobia, isn't he?
Right.
Yeah.
If he dies, then Faiul will succeed. And it does make specific mention in the glossary. It does make specific mention in the glossary that the spouse of the Saldean king or queen is not merely a consort, but a nearly equal co-ruler.
Yeah.
If it is him, if it is Bashir, the broken wolf, remember when we were talking to Virginia to Jen, and she was saying how she thinks, because we've always been talking about how Demondred is tame, and saying that Moradin is tame.
Moradin is tame, yeah.
Well, then he knows Bashir.
Yeah.
So Death has known him.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Nin had that viewing about something dark about Bashir, and she said to Rand, if he dies, you know, ..
Yeah.
I thought that might have been the attack on his wife, but not.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, the Moradin as Tyene theory. I have one big problem with it, but then I have another thing that's just as strong in the affirmative. My big problem with it is we've never seen Moradin as one to compulse as it seems Tyene has done in the Black Tower, to just go around compulsionifying everybody to his will. But on the other side of the coin, you know, we have in the second Grendel point of view with Grendel and Moradin, which is in chapter 5, it looks like, where we see where Moradin says, I have two dream spikes, actually. One of them is being put to good use, and the other one he gives to Grendel. Well, we see what the dream spike can do with the one that he gives to Grendel and Slayer. But the other one, you know, we see is at the Black Tower.
Right. At the Black Tower.
And we know that Moradin has always basically been behind Tyene since with his colors and everything else, so we know that he's obviously controlling him in one way or another, but the fact that that he actually could be him. And when you said compulsion, do you mean,
I mean the radical change of mindset that
I don't think that's compulsion.
Jahara and Tarna have.
I think that they're being turned by the 13th Forsaken and 13th Mydral. That was my take. And,
Jennifer's too, yeah.
Yeah, and I think I think that that's what's happening, is that they're basically being
turned. That's very interesting.
And then on the same, you know, train of thought, I think that that's also what we see at the end, in the epilogue with the Aiel. I was thinking that they were
all
the
Aiel. Yeah, but that can only happen to somebody who's a channeler.
Yeah.
They
the Aiel all have to
the
Aiel
They're
all
the channelers
have to
that went to the Blight. They can't channel.
Yeah, but the Aiel I'll have to disagree with, simply because what they are seems more in line with with Pat and Thane and or Dee than it does with any other with any dark friend that we know.
Oh.
But the
well,
but
I don't
the,
think they, I don't think they were dark friends. All the male channelers that went to the Blight to fight
yes.
the dark ones got
they,
turned
got
away
turned.
Yes.
And Slayer.
Yes. I think that's what happened.
Yes, but we
and they're also
we
wearing
don't.
Red, which is Morden's color, you know, red and black.
Yeah, but the crazy face of the filed pointed
the
teeth that doesn't
that.
Seem that seems more to me like the type of crazy that is Pat and Faye, not the type of crazy that is Morden.
Well,
and that's just how that's just what it seems like to me. And I could be way off.
But what? How would
but
Pat
we did
and Faye
see,
affect? Why would he just go after a whole bunch of Aiel and?
Yeah.
The same reason he went after a whole bunch of Trollocs.
Yeah, but he's always had connections with the Trollocs.
Armies.
Never.
He's just gathering armies.
But he's never had any connection whatsoever with the Aiel.
Well, neither has Morden, except for the ones that go to the Blight to die. Which we know.
Right,
Pat and Thane
but I'm saying that makes sense because Morden can deal with that because he's a Forsaken, whereas Pat and Thane doesn't have any access to them.
Pat and Thane's in the Blight. We see him in the Blight in the prologue. We see him in the Blight. Getting finding
yeah,
a worm and getting the Trollocs. He
has
much access to those Aiel that go to the Blight as Morden does.
All right.
Well, I think we're going to have a whole bunch of channeling crazy turned Aiel. I think. I think that they all
unless,
channel and that they're all. I think they were turned.
Yeah.
But
well, we can debate that probably for
right.
until the next book.
Well, actually, now you bring it up, I kind of agree with you because it doesn't seem like the normal compulsion as we know it.
Yeah.
No.
There's always been a raffo on the question of will we see
right.
someone turned
because
or have
says,
we seen?
He said something. Didn't he say something about where when you introduce something in a certain act, like Act One, you always have to use it or show your
hand
something by the third act or whatever. So basically, he's saying you're not going to see it for a while, but you're going to see it's going to play a part.
In my first interview with Brandon that Jesse and I did on the Mistborn tour, we asked him about a couple of things like that. He said he couldn't reveal anything about it. He said, but he could say that an author builds what they call narrative debt to the readership when they mention something that strongly more than once like that, especially. That at some point in time they have to resolve it or include it or deal with it because they have built up this narrative debt to the audience.
Right,
and
right,
it's just really bad form not to handle that.
It's some writing device, and there's an actual name for it that I can't think of, but I remember the description is, you know, in the first act you see the gun sitting on the mantle, and in the third act you see the gun being shot, and it solves the problems, basically. Andrew, do you remember what that device is called? Because I can't remember the actual name for it.
Oh, I just saw it. It was somebody's gun, not Pavlov.
Yeah.
Chekhov's gun, I think.
Chekhov's gun, yeah.
Yeah, Lee Butler actually brought that up in one of her Wheel of Time read-throughs.
You know, it's something that was introduced in one of the earliest books, you know.
Yeah.
We haven't seen too much of it. But, I mean, we brought it up constantly, but it hasn't been brought up in the book much since then. But, you know, we have to see it sometime. Otherwise, there's no reason for it to even exist in the world.
I think we've seen it a couple times, but I guess we'll find out.
Well, we've seen it mentioned a couple of times, but we've never actually seen it.
Well, I know we don't get to see the action being done, but I think we've seen the results, I guess.
We saw it almost being done.
Hmm.
We saw the prologue to it in Egwene's accepted test, where she's, you know, on the table and the murderer is clustering around her with the black eyes to die, and they're all ready to go, and she breaks free and channels wildly and destroys them all and escapes and goes to save Rand.
Yeah.
The little foreshadowing of the awesomeness that becomes Egwene in the Gathering Storm.
If there's any way to reverse the effect of the 13-13 turning, And to my mind, any way that would reverse the effects would have to somehow include the Ogier.
Personally, I would like to think it would be possible. What I'm guessing happens, just from when we do get that scene in the Black Tower, it seems to suggest to me that what happens in the conversion is that the Dark One pretty much just eats a large chunk of your soul, and you know, you're just it. What is there has your memories, but it's no longer you.
What Jennifer said when we discussed this a little bit last week was, because I kind of brought that up too, it kind of bothered me that they seemed so different. And she said, it doesn't really, it's not like compulsion. It doesn't take over anything or remove anything. What it does is it enhances all the darkest elements of a person's personality and subverts all the light tendencies that they ever had. So they become, they're still the same person. They're just, you know, it's sort of like in Buffy, it's like Dark Willow, not Good Willow anymore. They're just, they're the same person. They're just the completely evil, everything bad they ever thought about doing and thinking and being side of them. And that kind of makes sense to me because I don't know, it was obviously there's some change in personality because they're no longer good at all.
Yeah,
they're, just,
they're no longer the exact same person they were, so.
But they are in essence, yeah.
Right.
But all the parts of the personality were already there, just their darker nature is now to the forefront. And let's face it, most people in their normal development don't really have all the darkest elements of their nature to the forefront right from the get-go, unless you're David Hamlin or something. I mean, you know, a few like that, but, you know, most people aren't rabid serial killers and like that. They may have potential, but they never actually do it. You know, they're conditioned by our culture to be good. I don't know. That's
kind of
rampant.
I kind of pictured them, like how you brought up Buffy, I kind of pictured it, instead of like Dark Willow, I pictured them like vampires, like they don't have a soul, basically. Like how Andrew said that the Dark One eats a chunk of their soul, like I kind of pictured it like, because I know that it is said that when Jennifer, she actually read, I think she read it, that it takes all the goodness, like takes everything good away from them and brings all of their dark traits to the forefront. To me, when you say that, it just, I think of it as you're kind of losing your soul, and your soul is what's good in you, and you kind of lost that, so the only thing that's left is darkness. And so even though you maybe would still be the same person, you're going to change somewhat because your thinking is completely different from what it was beforehand.
And is that process instant, or is that process ongoing? Right. The other issue is that I always thought that the turning was more immediate. Right. So if we've seen, you know, if the idol at the end is an example of that, then that sort of contradicts what's happening to the Black Tower, because you would imagine the Black Tower effect, if Tame is using it, would be much more instant, or I imagine it to be much more instantaneous, not a sort of gradual turning. But once you're subject to it, it's much more instant.
I think it's instant, but I think that what they're doing is they're just taking certain individuals and turning them one at a time.
Yeah,
right?
I'm not prepared to
a group.
The biggest thing is that they mentioned, both in mentioning Tarna and the one dedicated who was raised very suddenly to Ashaman, who was one of Loghain's followers instead of Taim's.
Right.
Both of them, it seemed like they mentioned suddenly, like very quickly, they were someone else.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, and so I do. I very much agree that Taim is turning them very, you know, one or only just a very small amount at a time. I was just thinking, you know, honestly, he's having to be careful about it because all channelers are able to sense Murdrel and Trollocs. It's something that we've not really gotten very much book time with, but yeah, I remember there being a point of view somewhere where, you know, they mentioned somehow about, well, it's the one guy. It's the one Ashaman, or not Ashaman, but the dedicated who was following Nynaeve around. And he keeps, you know, talking about there being murder on the shadows.
No, but that was a function of his madness. And when she healed the madness and pulled the thorns out of his brain, he didn't see those murder anymore because they never did exist. I think the only reference we had to that was that Aes Sedai could sense shadow spawn.
And
I don't know if all channelers can, and the warders can. I don't know if all channelers can or only Aes Sedai. It makes sense that they all could.
Rand mentioned it in one of the earlier books, and it was a very subtle reference, but there was something about him knowing that they were coming. And actually, I think even in the Great Hunt or the Dragon Reborn, really early, Rand mentions about, you know, I knew they were coming and I could have done something.
Yeah.
But, you know, all he did was sit there and light some trees on fire. And,
but he was,
you know,
still learning then, too.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't very comfortable with his powers at that point, obviously.
He might not have recognized the sensation or whatever it is that he was feeling and linked it to them.
Yeah.
I do think that he sensed it.
Yeah.
I think that was in The Dragon Reborn.
But he
it was really early.
Yeah, and Perrin did too, but he would sense him through the wolf dream, but then he'd ignore it.
Right.
Because he didn't want to know. You know. But anyway, I think we're sort of going a little bit far afield here, which I don't think is a bad thing. I think that's a good direction to go, but since we're probably getting close to the end here, I want to throw in one last little thing that's been kind of bothering me. We've seen the reveal on Matt's letter from Baron now, and it was really bad news about Camelin. I had always sort of thought that letter would tell him where to find the Horn of Valyr. How's he going to find that now?
Swan
probably knows where it is.
So he would have to go to the White Tower.
But he doesn't know that Swan knows where it is.
Egwene would know that Swan knows where it is, and he sent a message to Egwene saying, "Hey, I'm coming to get it."
Right.
Wait a minute. Does Egwene know that? Swan tell her? I don't remember Swan ever telling her. Baron brought up the Horn of Valyr, and he hid it.
I need to know where it is. I'm sure she would ask her, because Swan was Omerlin at the time. You'd think that it would come up, wouldn't you? Or it could, if Matt asked.
I don't know. I don't remember.
You know,
Egwene,
I can't remember exactly even what happened, except that
they
hit it.
Nynaeve and Egwene, how did that work? They were taking Matt to the White Tower to be healed. Baron had the Horn of Valyr in a sack. The girls get there, but was it all three of them? I think it was.
Yeah, all three of them were returning.
Yeah.
And then...
But they weren't privy to Aes Sedai knowledge at that point in time. Moraine showed up and joined them. And, that was later. That was later. And then...
But, I mean, the point is that... As far as Egwene tracking the horn herself, Egwene knew the horn was there
in
the sack, in Matt's, with Matt. And she, along with Baron, who was the only Aes Sedai on their trip to the White Tower, and Elaine and Nynaeve, all get to the White Tower. We know Baron is almost immediately called to the Omerlin. Which she would have taken the sack to the Omerlin, so, you know.
Yeah, she talked to her.
But the thing is, from Egwene's point of view, that's what would have happened. So as far as Egwene could feasibly track the horn, the last place she would know it to be was somewhere with Varen and Sawan.
Yeah. I think that it would have to come up because, it's the last battle. Maybe it happened off screen and we're not really sure. Or however you want to put it, or maybe it's going to come up in the next book. But Matt's going to get it, right? So he must know that they have it, because that just, you would just think that that's the last place it was, and that they have it hidden away somewhere.
Well, I don't know what he's going to think. His memories of that period are pretty,
That's
pretty spotty. He was unconscious for most of that trip.
Yeah, but he could send one of his crazy letters to Egwene saying, "Hey, Egwene, what's up? Here, your Omerlin now. Do you know where the Horn of Valyr is?"
Yeah, I love that.
Just wondering.
By the way, I want my Horn of Valyr back. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Sorry, I married your major opponent.
Don't worry about me calling your Omerlin seat pretty. I'm married now, so you don't have anything to worry about.
Yeah, right.
I also have this image, Virginia, of the Horn of Valyr sort of showing up independent of Matt. You know, maybe delivered with other Tarangriel, because there has to be some. There was a lot of mention made of the stripping of Rudin of all of its items, and those being carted back to the White Tower. So, you know, I sort of had this image of the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where the Ark of the Covenant is sitting in a warehouse somewhere.
But,
right, there's this. there's this image of all of this, of this, of this storehouse in the White Tower that's just chock full of all of these items that, that have to be pulled out to be used at some point.
But those wagons never made it to Tar Valon.
No, they're
those
still
wagons,
in
they stayed in Tarion, and Rand hid them someplace. He hid the Concha someplace.
Right.
I actually brought this up one time, and it was told to him, no uncertain terms, that none of those wagons ever made it to Tar Valon, nor did any of the ones, any of the items from Tyr, their holding, really ever make it to Tar Valon either. So they're still in their respective cities. And I don't know that they stripped everything out of Rhuidean. They took a lot of it, but I don't think she took everything.
Well, yeah. What Alvienda actually says in this book is that the Moraine had taken several, and then others had come in and taken the rest, and the only thing that was left now was the columns and the
rings.
Arches. Rings, yeah, the that they have to go through.
The only big warehouse of Trangrail and Songrail and Ungrail that the White Tower has is what they already had in those storerooms that they usually just have protected by a novice. Duh.
That's insane.
And is that where the Horde of Valyria is hidden? Where Swan put it? Or do we think it's someplace else?
She might have.
I think she would be smart enough not to put them in a public access room, because every Aes Sedai has access to that storeroom.
Right. But when Padme Thane was there and he met Alviarin and he retrieved his ruby-hilted dagger, he thought to himself that there was something else there, but he wasn't going to get it right that minute. He had other things to do or something, and he left.
Right.
So presume that wherever they put the dagger, they put the horn.
I doubt it.
I don't think they would have put
the dagger with the other special Tarangrel and items of the power and things of legend that should not be touched because we're Aes Sedai and we say so.
You know, for all we know, he could have went back and taken it and nobody knows.
Well, no, the thing is I thought from Thane's words and when he was in the tower, I got the impression that the horn was someplace else. He was thinking it's here as in the White Tower somewhere, and that he just didn't have time. Because, I mean, honestly, if it were three shelves up on the right, you know, he could have been like, oop, dagger, oop, horn, and been gone. Although, now I have to say, though, Daniel, now I'm never going to be able to think about the storeroom for Tarangriel in the White Tower without hearing, that music from the... the weird imperial sort of music at the end of that movie.
I can just see the smoke rising from that storeroom, can't you? From all the objects of the power just sitting there raring to go.
I have to wonder, though. I can't imagine that getting the horn back is going to be just as simple as, boop, we're in the storeroom, boop, we grab it, boop, we give it to Matt, we're good to go. I can't imagine that they're going to do that.
That's why I think it'll be delivered. I don't think Matt will arrive the last battle with it. I think it's going to be delivered to him by some other character. I agree with you, actually, Spencer. I think it's got to come through some convoluted process that involves it arriving, you know, again, sort of in the nick of time when it needs to be sounded.
It could be Moraine. She knows where it is, too. I believe she and Swan were instrumental in hiding it.
Well, Moraine wasn't there, though. Moraine was with Rand in the Mountains of Mist at the time. And scene was Varen giving it to Suwan, and Suwan says, I will hide this in a place where only the two of us know.
I just thought that they talked, but maybe they didn't, Moraine and Suwan. You know, I think I really need to reread the...
I thought they had talked about it, but I guess not.
I don't think there would have been.
It was her and Varen, you're right. It was just Suwan and Varen. But how scary is that the Horn of Lyr spent all that time with a dark friend?
I know.
Not really.
Honestly,
but not really.
Knowing that it was Varen, it's not that frightening at all.
I know.
Yeah, not a dark friend.
I'm more frightened of the fact that it was with the brown, and I don't even want to know how much fucking fun he did to it.
I don't want to hear any more of your brown Aja prejudices. You know.
Just remember, Mesaana was a brown Aja.
Question for you guys. One of my friends on Facebook, Blake Rogers, he asked me a question about, which I was thinking about, it's about Birgitta wearing a sword.
Yeah, I brought that up too.
That just kind of happened, right?
I actually emailed that to Maria and didn't get an answer.
Okay.
Not even a mapo.
I was going to say, can we quote Brandon's new favorite response to questions, which beyond RAFO is now MAFO? I had never heard MAFO before.
Yeah,
I got a MAFO.
Yeah, he brought it. He created it last tour.
Yeah.
I missed it, so Maria and find out, which I love. So, anyway, yes. You got a MAFO?
I Maria and find out and got no answer. So, but I did qualify it because I when I first read it, I went, what? You know, she's been almost as adamant as an Aiel about not touching the sword, you know, because she never had touched one without either nearly getting killed or actually getting herself killed. And now all of a sudden she's wearing a sword. And then later in the book, it mentions again that she's wearing one reluctantly.
Right.
So
but
I'm thinking this
kind
is
of odd
this is,
after all that.
This
would
is
just think that it would be mentioned that why she's wearing one.
Well, you know what I think is it might be something along the same lines as if you remember in the Gathering Storm in Hinderstaff, actually, when Matt goes into Hinderstaff with the Aes Sedai, and he has Talmones and a couple of Red Arms with him, the Aes Sedai have three Red Arms with them. Well, in the first printings of the book, when you read that, the three Red Arms that go with the Aes Sedai never heard from again. Ever.
They're red shirts. That's why. They're red shirts.
Yeah.
Well, but in later printings, they realized their mistake and they got put back in. I assume I haven't read any of the later printings, so I don't know.
Well, let me provide a counterpoint to that. Doesn't Reed talk about the fact that she's worried about forgetting her past lives and that's beginning to leave her? So, in a sense, one of the things, you know, if you say she's always had problems in her past lives where she's encountered swords, she has swords, right? There's some proclivity within her, obviously, for a bow, but there's something where she interacts with swords. Maybe she's beginning to lose that connection. Right now,
well,
I think
she lost enough of her memories to lose that.
I don't think she would lose that anyway, because, I mean, you look at the Aiel, and they still have they don't like swords, even though no one except the clan chiefs know why they don't use swords. They just, we don't use swords. And I think it's kind of at that instinctual level is Brigitte's dislike of swords.
Well, my personal take on it is this is setting this up for Brigitte's going to be killed. I think that's I think that's crystal clear. I could be completely wrong. I frequently have been. But she's another powerful character. And, you know, at some point in time, somebody's got to die.
I know.
They've got too many good people in here. Some of them got to go. And I think we're just setting Brigitte up for a big fall.
Because she can never wear a sword because then she dies, blah, blah, blah. So now she's wearing a sword. She's going to die.
Yep, guess what? You're going to die.
Well, I agree that's probably possible that, you know, obviously she doesn't wear a sword because every time she, you know, tries to use a sword, there's a really easy explanation for that too, and that is that Brigitte just knows that she's not a swordswoman. I mean, if you know you have no skill with a sword, then walking around wielding a sword is only going to lead to you dying by somebody who actually knows how to use one.
I don't want to see Brigitte die either, but I think that's what we're setting up for now. I've become convinced. Anyway.
Well, I almost think that she has to, just so that she can be reborn, so that she's not creepy 20 years older than Guy Dahl.
Right. But doesn't Min have a...
Or even more.
Doesn't Min have a viewing of Brigitte with an ugly man that's a lot younger than her, but he's the same man that's old, that is older than her or something?
It wasn't actually a viewing, as I recall. She saw lots of images around her the way she always did with Aes Sedai. She surprised her because she knew that she wasn't a channeler. And she always seemed to have, you know, that connection to the older man who was not attractive or whatever, but she just saw lots of things around her, which I thought was kind of odd because
I just thought one of them was really young for some reason. It was a lot younger.
I think it was there was lots of.
I think you might be right.
Yeah, there were lots of viewings with her and the one man who is usually older, although in one case he was much, much younger. Here it is. Auras dance around her and images flickered more than Min had ever seen around anyone. Thousands of scenes cascaded over one of these multiple images, blah, blah. Strangely, some were connected to an ugly man who was older than she, and others to an ugly man who was much younger. yet somehow men knew they were the same man.
Huh.
So
okay. Okay. I don't know. Maybe I was thinking that it was just one of them was younger. But,
well, no, yeah. I think the others refers to other visions, not other
lives. Yeah, other past lives. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it refers strangely, some were connected to another. I'm going to change this again. Strangely, some of the viewings were connected to an ugly man who was older than she, and others to an ugly man who was younger, not some of the lifetimes. Because she says, you know, Gaidal is always born before me. Well, in this case, he was born before her, but she was ripped out. So
right.
Physically, she's much older than he is.
He is.
You know, Imbrigit being now much older than Gaidal, it sort of brought to mind Rand's little twit at Cad Swain constantly calling him boy. that was so nice because I mean it was him being kind of a smart ass, but at the same time it was really him. It's partially that, you know, well, what is Rand now? You know, what is his nature? You know, now that he's gone through this process. So obviously there's a lot more to Towers of Midnight than we can possibly fit in any one given episode. So we're going to break off for right now, and we will see you next time.
So this is Virginia saying thank you, everybody, for joining us. We hope that you enjoy listening to us discuss these fabulous books as much as we enjoy discussing them. And thank you, Andrew, Spencer, Daniel, and Carrie for joining us tonight. It's been great fun. And so until we meet again, may the light illumine you.
It was great to be back. I had a lot of fun.
Thank you for inviting me to join in, and wishing everyone a journey from courage to strength.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravyanendo Manchima, Taishite.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by Dragonmount.com. To contact us, visit our website, dragonmount.com/podcast.
Andrew, I have no skill with the sword. I'll volunteer for that one.
I don't think you're nearly pretty enough to be Brigitte, Daniel. I haven't seen you yet, but...
you should see my long blonde braid. It's just...
Okay, okay.
I'm going to have to make a new Twitter account that's the Horn Sounder and just do mat tweets all day long.
We're the Futurama.
Yeah. We're always Terminators.
As long as no one delivers a howler.
Oh, my God. Oh, I think probably Grendel got one of those.
So that was Varen's letter. Varen's letter was a howler, or a scream,
oh,
or whatever they were called.
Oh, with the red sealing wax, absolutely. That's why that didn't want to open it. He knew it was a howler. You needed somebody to tell him, don't put it off, they just get worse.